Hello, and welcome to Kaplan Connects, the podcast where we talk about single dealer platforms, trading technology, and everything in between. I'm John Ashworth. In each episode, we'll dive into the trends, tools, and talent shaping the future of electronic trading. Join me as we unpack what's new and what's next. It's my very great pleasure to welcome Sean Durkin to this episode of Kaplan Connects. Sean is the director of EFX at First Citizens Bank and has had a journey that started as a software engineer working for FSS Spectrum. He spent about 9 years there before moving to Charles River and then time with Silicon Valley Bank, the journey into First Citizens of which I'm sure he'll describe to us somewhat. Sean, welcome to Kaplan Connects.
Thanks for having me. Very happy to be here and have a good conversation.
Good. Now tell us more about the journey that you've taken.
Yeah, so in university, I majored in math and computer science, which it seems in our industry, there is a lot of variety of backgrounds and, you know, maybe non-traditional backgrounds. And I didn't have any intention to get into financial markets or financial technology. One of the things our university had was a mandatory internship program as part of it. And I kind of learned what I didn't want to do in a very low stakes environment.
What was that?
Well, there were sort of two things. One company I interned for was quite small. So the interaction of getting real work, even as an intern and feeling a part of a mission was good. But the actual meat and potatoes of the work was kind of pure hardware programming. So sort of the math angle wasn't as interesting to me. And then the second internship was a very large company, and you kind of just got the sense of, hey, you're the intern in the corner and nothing much interesting happened. So I kind of exited those two experiences and said, okay, I'm not quite sure exactly what I want to do, but I want to use both majors where I feel like the work is material and I'm a part of something. And that's kind of the mindset I went into applying for roles at a university and, quite frankly, got a little lucky that a firm outside Philadelphia, which is where I went to school, a financial software firm, I think I was around the 30th, 35th employee, financial software systems at that time, you know, two owners, small company, a lot of different types of clients. And, you know, quite frankly, I didn't quite know how lucky I was at the time and signed up there as a C-sharp engineer and within 2 years was doing option pricing in C++ and all that fun stuff.
Good stuff. What were your peers at Drexel doing?
It's a good question. You know, some, and there was a lot of shared majors with, you know, math and computer science. It was only really, you had to do another 5 classes to get both, right? So some of the people that might have over-indexed to math might have went down sort of the pure actuarial route, which, you know, very interesting and intellectually stimulating in its own right, but maybe less so at that time. Technical, and then some other folks went down the pure programming route, but were sort of agnostic to the domain that they sat in, and I did care about that. I wanted to be interested, even though I didn't quite know what I wanted yet, I knew I wanted to be interested in the domain I was in. So I kind of saw that and learned from that, and I will say another experience I learned from is I took a graduate class as an undergraduate, and I sort of had this romantic notion of graduate school and, you know, getting master's or PhD in math and all this sort of stuff, and I quickly learned that all the problems and challenges that may arise at that time, my immature 21-year-old view of, quote, corporate life, exists in academia as well. So that was quite a, oh, you know, this is not some romantic vision of pure 100% fun all the time. And that sort of gave me a good groundedness of, okay, corporate life is quite fine and can be quite fun. And, you know, academia has its own set of issues and challenges.
You must have been tutored by master's students and PhD candidates who were probably inspiring you or not inspiring you.
Yes, I would say a mix of both. I mean, some were great, you know, teachers and mentors in terms of explaining complicated concepts and clearly had a love, that love for the domain, but then you could pick up on maybe, you know, some stuff that was dragging them down. And, you know, we all have that in our entire life and career and different choices. But again, it was sort of a, it took it with the time, which we've all been there, you know, early 20s, immature notions of, oh, there's some perfect thing to do that will give you all your hopes and dreams, more of, no, there's going to be challenges, anything you do. So kind of over-index for what you want, learn along the way and adapt, which I think has been a big theme of my career and has served me well with adaptation.
And had you done C-sharp at school?
Yeah, the program was pretty good in that regard in terms of, at that time, you know, C-sharp, Java, C++ were kind of the main. There was even some more, maybe at that time, exotic languages. They tried picking different languages to teach you the concepts. And then if you had the concepts, you could sort of adapt to whatever's thrown at you.
What was the most exotic?
I think something called Lisp, which was very like at that time, I guess at that time, what we would now call rudimentary machine learning, right, sort of stuff. And that's probably the one. There's a couple others I can't even remember, but you know, they did a good job of making it practical, but trying to give you a variety of exposure, and you could pick your different tracks, you know, so there was some at that point. Again, this is 2005, but even at that point, there was a human-computer interaction track, there was an algorithms track, there was a more, you know, mathematical track, so you could kind of mix and match them.
So you were attractive to FSS because you have this kit bag of useful program languages from the computer science track. In the math track, had you done any financial modeling? I mean, did you know what Black-Scholes was?
No, nothing at all. But the beauty of that role at FSS is, you know, I started out kind of, again, getting a variety of, they had front office tools, back office tools, all sorts of different things within the products. Strong in FX, but still had different asset classes too. So I kind of got a little buffet of each early on in the career. But at that point, still nothing about option pricing or modeling or any of that fun stuff. And I remember there was one project where we had to add a new option type to the product end-to-end, right? Not just the pricing, but even the deal capture and all that sort of stuff. And my boss said, okay, you have to add this to the product. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, that would be a great first thing to figure out.
Can you remember what it was?
I think it was some flavor of a binary option or something like that.
What are we talking about here? Calendar year, roughly.
07, 08, okay. Oh, maybe even 09, that range.
So had Lehman's collapsed by then?
Probably, yeah. So probably that was while I was there a year or so and had that sort of broad intro that I talked about. And then when I started to get into more of the, I kind of, again, this wasn't intentional, but over time sort of focused on more of the front office part of the product, the pricing aspect of the product, which had hooks into different components like the margin engine and different things. Again, very, in a way, unintentional, but that was probably around, you know, 08, 09, which still at that time, 24, 25-year-old, kind of in the adjacent space. It's sort of like, what's happening? How do you digest all this? But I would say some of that definitely piqued my interest of, well, what are these more complex products? Why did this go haywire? How do people express risk to people incorrectly or correctly? How do people overcomplicate things, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes intentionally, things like that.
And what was Spectrum doing with option pricing? Was it valuing positions that it was holding? I mean, I don't think it was doing decision support pricing or pre-trade pricing, was it?
No. So I'd say, you know, it really depended on the client use case. And one of the things, again, I didn't necessarily realize at the time, but there were certain clients that were sort of your classic regional bank who may need sort of the software bank-in-a-box approach, everything from deal capture, some basic blotter, some basic reval, at least to compare to market pricing for sanity checking purposes. All the back office modules, Swift messages, you know, everything soup to nuts, right? But we also had some clients in EMEA and elsewhere that just used our margin engine calculation module and integrated that with all their other suites of products. And we also had some wealth management clients in APAC who used some similar things, but in even more structured and complex products like FX accumulators and all these sort of embedded option structures, whereas the brokers in EMEA, you know, used some options and stuff, but maybe not some of the more exotic structured products. So long story short, the margin engine at some point to say, okay, this client has traded this basket of assets, their margin line is X, are they at the call level, cut level, auto cut level, has to have some reasonable proxy of evaluation. So therefore, we had some reasonable proxy of an option validation model, but you know, we weren't an option pricing system. So that was also a very interesting learning experience because, you know, the stakeholder at a client who may have sponsored the project or put their budget on the line for the whole suite, you know, was operating at a high level, obviously, but, you know, I may have been facing off with someone in the valuation team who's kind of, you know, nitpicking over every little thing. And I had to sort of pause and say, well, the whole system is trading on leverage and margin here. It's not like a proprietary pricing system. Are we really debating this for the sake of debating it? It was a good sort of practical realization that, you know, within any project and bank, there's people thinking at different levels. And when is it being exactly correct, absolutely necessary versus when is close enough, good enough, and navigating different stakeholders who may have different perspectives and motivations was an interesting learning experience.
That leads me to ask, how good were the banks you were selling to? How good were they at selling these structures and solving risk management problems for customers? And how good were the customers at buying them? Because there's a whole bunch of technology and sophistication in the complex financial product arenas, but the regulators had views about that. And I'm just interested to know what it was like then. You know, how good were the banks at selling this stuff and how good were the customers at buying it?
I think number one, definitely region dependent for sure, and client mindset dependent. One thing for certainly some of the APAC clients, with clients in APAC, there was just at that time, and maybe even still, even more of a cultural gambling mindset just at the core, versus like, hey, I view that as an investment product. Whereas if you talk to a US everyday person with a 401k, they wouldn't think of complex structures as investment products. So in a way, sometimes the banks at that time, depending on the client base in the region, didn't have to do much selling because the clients wanted it. Right. The clients were doing the buying. But it was at that time where things were changing in terms of perspective on, you know, are these things client appropriate? Probably the beginnings of the more rigorous KYC and appropriateness types of discussions that have only, you know, expanded over time. So I don't think that time was sort of the, you know, full-blown Wild West days, but it was definitely a transition point where if a client wanted something, the bank would provide. And at that 09, 10, 11 region, bank client-based dependent, there wasn't as much mandatory rigor or best practices as there is today with some of that product appropriateness, client appropriateness type things.
Interesting. So you were having this charmed life at FSS and worked your way through the company and ended up, I think, as a product manager.
That's right.
And then some time with Charles River.
Yep.
I'm accelerating your career here, but stop me and pick out the big waypoints. What were the big issues at Charles River that you learned and that you enjoyed? And then tell us how that then segued into Silicon Valley Bank.
So I think one thing that at that point, you know, I had started to be a little more intentional in my career choices, as I think we all do as we get more experience and go down the road. And I was at that time that I knew I wanted something a little different. But at that point, I had 8 years of experience in financial markets and being able to think about software and talking to traders or back office personnel. And I didn't want to pivot industries entirely. So the Charles River opportunity came about with a recruiter reaching out. But as I researched the company, I said, okay, well, this is more buy side than sell side type of workflow. This is more securities than FX type of workflow. There was obviously FX overlay workflows and stuff in the CRD suite as well. And I kind of realized, oh, this might be a good fit where I can apply the core principles of financial technology, breaking down complex problems, listening to stakeholders. Is a portfolio manager doing, you know, a duration-based bond portfolio different than an FX trader? True enough, but is some of the mindset similar of, you know, listening what they really want, making it complicated when they want it, but simplifying it when they want it simple? Some of those patterns could apply. So I ended up there. Originally, I actually applied for an FX role, but due to some internal reprioritization, they said, would you be actually interested in this wealth management product role? Because obviously their bread and butter throughout their history at that time was sort of your classic asset manager install and client, but they were trying to get more into some of these bigger wealth shops where they would sell the sort of end-to-end portfolio management experience for not just the financial advisors managing the portfolio, but all the orders generated on the back of that, passing compliance, getting routed either to internal traders or auto OEMS tools, which hopefully was also CRD, but even if it integrated somewhere else, that was okay as well. So I worked on their rebalancer engine during my entire time there. But the interesting thing is it was more for those kinds of wealth management clients. And I think one of the big things I learned there is just separating, you know, the simplicity when you need it and the complexity when you needed it, right? Some of the financial advisors would have tens of thousands of accounts based on a model. They wanted one-click rebalancing that was correct, and they would spot check it, but wouldn't have to think about it too much. Maybe some of the more niche fixed income portfolio managers would really want to look at every single tweak and toggle and decision support and kind of drill you on how your rebalancer algorithmically came up with stuff. And, you know, it was our job to satisfy both types of clients in a product that could do that intelligently and not too custom, so to speak. So yeah, it was a great experience there. I, you know, from a personal perspective, I moved from Philly to Boston at that time for that role. So that was another sort of life change that was quite interesting. So then I was there about 5 years there.
What was the biggest culinary shift going from Philly to Boston?
Definitely some land animals for some sea animal arbitrage for sure. So that, you know, definitely seafood is something Boston gets quite right. So yeah, I stayed in Boston when I took on the, at that time, Silicon Valley Bank role, but I stayed in Boston for about 8 years. So it's a great time. Did all your classic New England trips and fairs and all that good stuff. So definitely took advantage of my time there.
So Silicon Valley Bank in Boston, but not really in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so there's an interesting backstory there. So someone I had actually worked with at FSS back in the day had at that time been, and still is, at now First Citizens, at that time Silicon Valley Bank, for I think he had been there 10 years and now about 15 at this point, kind of reached out of the blue of, hey, we're in the process of bringing on a new FX aggregator system, and we've got great salespeople and great traders, but we need someone in the business to help implement this.
Were they building it or buying it?
Buying it.
Are we allowed to know what it was?
So at that time, it was TickTrade, which subsequently was acquired by SmartTrade, I think about 3 or 4 years after that time, something like that. So at that time, the business had evolved to the point where some centralized pricing and EFX workflows were just needed. End of story, right? So that made total sense that they were going down that journey. And he kind of thought of me of, hey, you know, you've always been on the software side. This is a front office role in a desk, but you could help be the sort of bridge between the two worlds, so to speak. And the reason Boston was palatable or relevant there is, at least within the FX franchise, based on client location, there's a decent-sized FX sales team in Boston for the life sciences and fintech, you know, as well. Maybe not as much as Silicon Valley or even New York or other cities, but Boston had a, you know, still healthy fintech set of clients. A lot of life sciences clients, startup life sciences firms in the Boston area.
And a whole bunch of notable schools just spewing out talented technologists,
right,
and startups and,
right,
things.
Right. So at that time, the three main, at least, concentrations for staff, and obviously there was clients all over at that point the world in the US, but Boston, New York, and obviously the Bay Area being the big one, that was kind of the three, at least where there were FX people in each of those pre-COVID actual offices going in every day, so you could kind of learn from each other. And so great opportunity. I signed up and I spent so much time in San Francisco my first month. Some colleagues thought I actually lived there when I said I lived in Boston. Like, what do you mean you live in Boston? You're here every week. I'm like, yeah, I have to learn things and meet you guys and make relationships, of course, which then, you know, I got, again, lucky in March of 2020 when the world changed. I, at that point, was a, you know, real human being who had tried to make relationships and learn about people's needs and workflows versus, you know, a Zoom Square kind of thing. I don't envy anyone who had to change companies or roles or anything in that, you know, early COVID time. It's very, very difficult to make those connections virtually.
So the job you were brought on to do was to, well, supervise and implement this new aggregator technology. Did they have all the other bits as well, or did that come later?
A little bit on the risk-taking side. So at that point, and still today, 360T was used as the trading with other counterparty banks and risk management system. But one of the things that wasn't plugged in altogether was, okay, how is pricing distributed out to clients, right? And there was a couple different channels that served their purpose and did quite fine, but it wasn't centralized, it wasn't totally clean, and there were opportunities at that point where things like doubling down more on APIs and other integration points just couldn't be done with the stack as it is. So that was kind of the impetus at the time for that, you know, vision. So there were ups and downs to all that, but in a way it was a great learning experience, not just for me, but the team as well. We've certainly evolved quite a bit, as we can get into, but I think going through a project like that, whether you're in a sales seat, a trading seat, a product seat, you start to learn the patterns, the needs, the questions to ask, the pitfalls, the things that you might, you know, obsess over this niche kind of thing or feature that you reflect on. Actually, well, you know, the clients didn't really need that, so we maybe burnt too much calories on that. So it was a great learning experience, I think, for all the folks that went through it at the time, you know, no matter what their particular seat was.
And again, what was the outlook and the experience level of the clients like? I'm imagining the technology companies, by and large, they're early stage, by and large, full of smart people, probably taking investment funds from different parts around the globe, and they've got natural trading and FX exposure. But how much were they pushing you product-wise?
No, this is an excellent point. So I'd say at that time, probably 80, maybe even 90% of the total clients, now that other 10 or 20% may have an outsized influence based on flow or those sorts of things. But the large majority of the clients, they weren't expressing it in terms of certainly technology needs or FX needs in particular. They just wanted a seamless process, right? If they're a client who's making a simple international payment, you know, quite frankly, they may not even think of it as doing an FX transaction. They just need to send payroll every month to Estonia to pay for their developers doing and they're focused on their core business, right? Like one of our things that we take pride in then and today, and one reason it's been a good fit with First Citizens is putting ourselves in the client's shoes and thinking their passion is their business. Now we can help them with that in terms of providing counsel on what international exposure means and what FX means as they go through their own journey. To your point, startup is very different than mid-stage or pre-IPO, post-IPO. But FX is probably most times not going to be their passion, what they think about every day, right? And that's an important thing to be able to offer that counsel and help, but also to understand their core business very fundamentally. And that's one reason we've always been very big on segment specialization. And that's another thing that First Citizens also has been very strong on. So that's been a good fit in terms of how we approach clients and sort of hiding that complexity. Right. So if we implement a new EFX engine, tech stack, whatever behind the scenes, for a lot of clients, they may end up getting ultimately better service, but it's sort of transparent to them. Now, there is certainly another, like I mentioned, 10, 20% of the clients that would say, hey, I'm trading with multiple banks on a trading platform at FXall or the like, and I would like to give you a chance to be in that pool, but you need that kind of connectivity or something else, right? So there's a little bit of a mix, but the main kind of impetus was, yes, there's some clients who want to come and meet us and trade on certain venues where we need the connectivity points, but a lot of the other clients, we just want it seamless price delivery without them having to know about or care, quite frankly, about all those complexities, but giving them a appropriate price that's appropriate for them and appropriate for us from a risk management standpoint and striking that right balance.
And presumably a whole bunch of clients for whom you've been the current account provider and the debt provider, and if not providing the equity finance for things, at least facilitating relationships with private equity companies and so on.
Yeah, there's a lot of clients that are captive in that sense, for sure. And certainly even pre the 2023 events, but certainly post that, there's certainly been some clients that have gone more in the multi-bank space, and we quite understand why that's the case.
The captive ones, does that mean, without betraying any trade secrets here, they could be less sensitive about price?
I would say it's more about the holistic service from their standpoint. So, you know, they might have someone within their firm that does the mechanics of, again, it might be from their standpoint of making payment. That could be dollar payments. It could be payments in other currencies, right? When they think about, at that point, Silicon Valley, or quite frankly, some of those customers may still think of it as Silicon Valley Bank, even though it's First Citizens Bank now, they're kind of thinking about the holistic end-to-end servicing of everything they need. So FX may be one part of that, but not the only part. And that's one thing, obviously, as a markets team, we're very driven and incentivized and care about financials and numbers and all these kind of things, but we really do try to look to the holistic client relationship. In other words, if there's a client doing lots of valuable things with other entities in the bank and we can help them in FX, where if you just transactionally analyzed it, you might say, that's not a great, quote, trade. You know, we still might do that, and we think that's a competitive advantage. Other banks that might be more siloed might say that, hey, it doesn't make sense economically. No offense, can't do it. That's one thing our salespeople are quite good at, our FX salespeople, is making connections with the kind of relationship manager owners in the various parts of the bank of, hey, how can FX help you, right? And that could be very different things to very different clients.
But I think the point in the journey where we've got, as you say, and put it very well, these captive clients who actually value the holistic relationship that they're getting from the bank, because they're doing a whole bunch of other stuff as well, which means they're captive, but probably not so captive they want to be taken advantage of. Right. But then you've got people who are actually a lot smarter and want to see you on multi-dealer platforms. Was your pricing good enough for them not to giggle at that point? Were you competitive at that stage, or was that your job?
You hit the nail on the head. I'd say that's been one of our favorite words is a journey. That's been a journey. But, well, number one, some of the clients that may have gone through their own journey may reach that of, oh, do you have those sorts of connectivity? And depending on what year they asked us, we say, yeah, actually, we can do that. It's like, oh, didn't know you could do that. No problem. We can do that. Obviously, you know, those types of clients are going to be more price sensitive, but oftentimes what we've seen is they'll sort of say, hey, because we holistically value the relationship, even though we may be going multi-bank for FX, we want you in the pool, we want you in the consideration, and try to pull your weight and win enough deals to make yourself relevant. But if you do that, and then there's a more bespoke need, maybe a FX phone trade, or a more bespoke need that's even outside of FX, then I kind of just need to show my folks that have invested in getting us into whether it's an FXL or some platform that you're relevant. And that rang true for me because that's sort of how we communicate with our counterparty banks too, of we don't have a strict e-invoice divide maybe as some of the larger banks need, although that's, you know, in a way changing, quite frankly, over time. But we look at it holistically, right? Of, hey, if you are pulling your weight on e, then you're going to get a more of a look invoice. So that sort of same mindset, it sort of triggered an aha moment of like, oh, they're sort of saying without saying, look, you don't need to win one divided by X of your share every time. But if you're top of mind enough that you're winning enough of the more automated G10 tickets spot, then for some of this more bespoke stuff, you'll be in the mind of people to think about. So that was good because then you still want to be competitive on that stuff, but you don't have to burn so many calories to, you know, win every trade every time. You have to be relevant enough to be relevant. And then hopefully for the stuff where we can more differentiate versus the more basic G10 commoditized tickets, then we can differentiate.
You've spoken a bit about your multi-dealer platform strategies and modes of operation. What were you doing single dealer platform wise, if anything, at that time?
I would say in terms of how most people might traditionally think of a single dealer platform, you know, we didn't really have one, but what we had at the time and now have doubled and tripled down on is delivering FX workflows within the broader bank digital strategy. So one thing that's very important for many of our, probably say all, but probably most or many is I want anything I do with the bank in general, one experience. Again, clients that are also trading on multi-dealer might be an exception to this, but in general, and this rings true in our daily life, right? If you have, you know, your own bank or your own whatever service provider that you do 2, 3, 4, 5 things, your own, you know, financial advisor, you don't want to go to 5, 6 different software packages, people, whatever. You kind of want it centralized as possible, right? So a big focus was basically delivering those kinds of FX workflows within one framework. And I say different because that is quite important. Again, some clients may be just payments. They don't trade derivatives. They don't think about price refresh, price sensitivity. They just need a very simple, I need to make a payment. I need the money to get there. Sure, I might compare the rate to somewhere else just to spot check, but that's not the primary driver of things. And I just need it to be simple, repeatable, and also some maker checker type rules for my own staff of maybe a junior senior type person at their institution. And that's all I need. But another client might say, yeah, actually, for some kind of our FX activity, we do want to have a more trading centric kind of GUI or this or things where we can deal right away and then add payment instructions on later. It was a very important, I believe, choice to make sure those were not totally different products from our standpoint. They're just different workflows within the same digital chassis that then can be permissioned depending on the client need. So we can still say from a corporate standpoint, hey, you're logging into the corporate digital experience. Client A, you might have one FX workflow. Client B, maybe two. Client C, maybe four. But you don't have to install an entirely different suite of software. And sometimes that happens, and there might be legitimate reasons for that. But that, for most of our clients, that kind of a non-starter. So that was important to work with our, and obviously we have a whole digital team within the bank that's focused on the chassis, things like user administration and those common features that as an FX department, we don't really want to spend time on that. We just want to deliver our FX workflows into the digital platform, right? So that's been important. That's certainly been something we've evolved over the years. And obviously clients in the First Citizens segments have a suite of digital tools as well. First Citizens as a bank, we've grown through acquisitions. So whether it be SVB, CIT, so we're now at another sort of point to look at all the sort of FX channels and say, okay, how do we, again, simplify this, consolidate this, make it frictionless from a customer experience standpoint? So the work is never done.
In this journey, and you're describing the configuration of First Citizens extremely well, but I think we all know that there were some front page headlines involving, yes, Silicon Valley Bank. There was, for want of a better phrase, a systematically based hiccup. But you seem to have come through that pretty well. And it seems that you're balancing the customer's needs, for want of a better phrase, a Silicon Valley Bank brand, with those who are more than happy with the First Citizens brand. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing, obviously, the March 10th event happened, and that is what it is. But when First Citizens bought us, you know, in the early stages, everyone's sort of getting to know each other from a perspective. But one thing I give great credit to the top of the house on is listening to clients. When you obtain a new bank, or if you're a software provider, another vendor, or whatever acquisition, Well, I'm obtaining a lot of new clients. So let's talk to those clients, particularly in a relatively tension-filled last 3-6 months, and see what their headspace is, right? So that was done by literally top of the house senior leaders at First Citizens. And quite frankly, that impressed me to go and say, I'm going to meet with this many clients of SVB and see what they think. And, you know, I think they probably staged the timing intelligently, not necessarily month two, month three, but at the right time to get a good ear to the ground, but let some time have passed. And I think what they found loud and clear was, okay, that was a very turbulent time. And, you know, maybe even that client might have even pulled their cash for a time, but then redeposited or what have you. But they said, you know, when we thought about it, how you service our needs is very important to us. And some of us want to still think of, we know that First Citizens as a bank now owns the brand and the servicing, but we still think of it as SVB. And that's actually important to us. And because that came from the clients, the top of the house has made that true within how they deal with the brand, even internally. And that's great, right? Because if the client says it, then it's gold. It's not someone just pitching it for their own internal reasons. Conversely, though, to your point, First Citizens Bank had clients doing FX well before SVB showed up. Some similar needs, some different needs. We have a middle market banking strategy that, you know, it might be different industries, but some of the journey is similar of, you know, corporates at a size between X and Y that have grown to a certain sophistication and might need some more international needs and counseling, but are not yet, you know, a behemoth type corporate. Perhaps different industries, but some shared patterns or talking points or these things. So that's another thing that I will give a lot of people credit for is there's sort of corporate integration and those things take time, right? We understand why. But one thing I saw very early on, if there was a hungry and intuitive and curious and well-intended salesperson on one side of the house and a similar person here, and they had similar client bases or sometimes even a shared client in some cases, they just worked together to get it done. There was very little territorial. It's like more of an excitement of, oh, now I can actually deliver something to this client I couldn't 6 months ago. This is great. Was every single interaction perfectly like that every time? Of course not. But I think the rule more generally was not. And that matters a lot because every company on earth is going to say client first, right? And sure, of course. But when you see it, you believe it yourself. And when you believe it yourself, you then act it out. So it's a virtuous circle. So I think that's been one thing that's been very, very important. And even if you're a bank or a provider or any company that grows through acquisitions, and you have kind of your acquisition playbook and strategy, and it works, makes sense, but not all acquisitions are created equal. And I give tremendous credit to the leaders that said, you know what, this is a little different. Let's listen to the clients. Let's digest that. As we're doing corporate integration, sort of, you know, top down, let's also do some organic integration bottom up and encourage that thinking. You know, everyone has their businesses, their P&Ls, their operating costs. But if a client wants to do things across the verticals, let's figure out how to do that.
That all arose from a geoeconomic singularity. There's another geoeconomic singularity recently in the form of tariffs. What impact is that having on your customers and their appetite and trading habits?
Well, I think one thing is remains to be seen in some sense, and I say this because even in our day and age where supply chain disruption can happen quite quickly, there are certain times where the impact on the downstream supply chain takes some time, right? So one thing we've seen is that, number one, some clients might just kind of want that sort of more, hey, I don't think this will fundamentally change my business and my international needs, but can we sort of discuss this? And we're quite happy to do that. We have some folks in our sales organization who really focus on that sort of role of, hey, this is what we're seeing in the market. This is, you know, our sort of view on things. You know, we never, for very important reasons, it's not advice because that is a loaded term, but that sort of counsel, right? So we've seen some pickup on that where those sort of functions where we've had more, you know, little one-page white papers and those kinds of calls with clients to sort of drill in, but also be very transparent of, well, this is how we think it will and may evolve, but things constantly change by the headlines as we've seen. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. A lot of our clients did want to delve in and discuss it and sort of understand how it might impact their business, but they're not necessarily seeing it yet bottom line wise, but they're being proactive about it. And we're here to help kind of counsel on that. And I wouldn't say there's been for us any sort of flow correlation as much as some other types of institutions, but I certainly saw in the early days there was that sort of proactive interest and wanting to discuss things. And for us, that's great because there may not be deals or trades behind that, but those are the kinds of things where if it does 6-12 months have a material impact to that client's business, then they value that upfront kind of conversation and less so about, let me sell you an FX solution. Let me understand how this might impact your business. And an FX solution might be the appropriate thing, or it may not, depending on your circumstance.
You've talked a lot about the service ethic of the bank you're now working for, but we're also living in a world where it's impossible to turn the pages of any media without discussing AI. It's 2025. So much more is being digitized. So much is being more automated. It's quite a philosophical question, but where do you see the role of humans in the trading environment going forward?
So the way I've always thought of this is, you know, I think disintermediation in general has been a big theme of just the world, for lack of a better term, in the last 10 years. But that's a two-way street, right? Because I'm sure we've all had that life experience where we're trying to get some, you know, basic life need and it's your phone call is routed to a call center with a touchpad and you're clicking different options. You're like, boy, I just want a human. If I could just have someone to talk to, then maybe you get a human, but they're reading off a script and it sounds robotic and cold and lifeless as if it was a robot. That's kind of using technology in a way that's not going to really make your customer, your client happy. On the flip side, there could be certain situations where someone needs something quite simple. They may interact with some kind of chat bot and they actually get what they need right away. And they're like, wow, this is great. So I think it's being open-minded that whether it's that sort of client service example all the way up to trading and risk management, it's what is the right tool for what you're trying to accomplish. If there are simple, repeatable things that don't take much judgment, relationship management, thought process, or it's kind of the hot term AI assistant. Well, your assistant may not decide the risk choice, but they can help you collate things, you know, maybe think of things you hadn't or summarize things better. There's no real harm on it until you decide to action it, right? So I think it's people being open-minded that this is not going away, right? The speed is only going to pick up. So being open to it, learning about what it's good for, what it's not good for, depending on your types of clients, your bank, your software provider, your seat in that place. You know, maybe for a salesperson, like, wow, there's a lot of sort of CRM level tier one, tier two stuff where this is great and helpful. But then when I pivot to deeply understanding the customer relationship, that is where the human is helpful. A trader might say, you know what, a lot of these kinds of tickets that really not a ton of alpha, just need to kind of move things along. Algorithm, boom, done. But this ticket where I'm calling up another counterparty in an illiquid time, you know, in a chat for size, relationships matter there. So I think it's being open-minded, whether it's servicing your clients, servicing your internal functions, that it's not going away. So just accept that. Think about what it means for your clients, your role, your institution, where it's good, and also look at the pitfalls and where it may be too much. And I think if people keep that mindset, just that learning mindset and curiosity mindset, I think, at least in our corner of the world, it'll be a good thing. There's certainly some larger macro ethical human choices around what AI should and could do or not do, but I'll leave that to people much smarter than myself. But I think the main thing is just this is not going away, right? So you can try to put it in a corner and lock a closet and ignore it, but when you open up the closet, it'll be 10 times more complicated and you'll be behind the curve. So
I'm getting from what you're saying the opposite, that actually there's a huge amount of space for smart, curious, well-informed, STEM-educated humans to actually interact with customers. If you're only talking about wings and the football game and having a beer, I don't think that's going to cut it, but I think there is room for humans who are smart and curious.
I think that's an excellent point, because one thing on, if you flip it from a client's mindset, is just the scale of technology and learning, whether, you know, search engines, AI, whatever's next, right? People can get information. Now, sometimes it's bad information or sometimes it's too much information, but I think the global, for lack of a more eloquent term, the global BS detector of just the human race is higher than 10 years ago, period. So to your point of the old, you know, in U.S. presidential elections, oh, I'm voting for him because I'd love to get a beer with, like, that's very passe, I think, at least. But to your point, there are things that relationship-based, at least for now, AI machines can't replace deep understanding of motivation. You know, at the end of the day, for now, we're all still human. So what's that business leader's motivation at his or her core? What is the client mindset at their core? What is their hopes and dreams? It sounds a little corny and frou-frou at times, but this is how people actually operate and transact. And yes, the economics have to make sense. We're in a bottom line industry. You can't just have the relationship without the meat and potatoes to back it up. But if you don't have any of that, I think this is at times overused, but it's a valid enough term, EQ, to kind of marry the IQ and the EQ, then people are more attuned to that than they were a decade ago.
What have you got in the next 18 months? What are you building out?
Great question. So we talked about journey is one of our favorite words at the bank. Integration is one of our other favorite words. So obviously the bank has grown through acquisitions and they've taken time to digest those at a reasonable and prudent pace. But at some point, whether it's for your own internal reasons or regulators, you know, rightly so, it's like, well, are these functions integrated? How, if someone says, hey, come show the org chart of this part of the organization, that part of the organization, there's some tolerance in, depending on the size and scope of any acquisition, you know, first year or so, like, okay, we're working on it. Some things are a little messy here and there, but we're moving in the right direction. At some point, it's like, this has to be rationalized, right? So how that affects us in the FX business specifically is that we've got one set of clients that we service in different segments and vertical specializations. But in terms of workflows, channels, sort of broad customer experience, internal systems, which is, you know, sort of shouldn't matter to the end client, but matters to us to deliver a service in an efficient way. There's been a big push to the bank to rationalize and integrate all that, which is fantastic from my perspective in an EFX seat of saying, great, these sort of issues in the stack that may have been here for years, now there's a motivation, checks, goals, projects behind all that with real ROI that can be proven out. And also that thematically ties into what the top of the house wants at a thematic level of behave as one bank, have client level specialization, but keep things simple, reduce complexity when needed, don't have duplicated offerings, don't have clients hear two, three different answers to the same problem. So it's a good kind of place to be where those very top of the house themes marry to what we in our FX seats try to do kind of in a way every day. So that's the big focus at the moment. And it's funny, you said 18 months because that's pretty much the main, you know, there's obviously BAU and keeping things running along, but in terms of big project type items, those are the main focus. And we're sort of proactive and I think prudent but intelligent about it. If in the scope of those types of integration thematic projects, we can say we can combine, reduce, simplify, and while still meeting time and budget, actually add one or two things for this type of client, that type of segment, all in one bundle, no one's going to say no to that. Where prudence is required as well, you know, the first goal is the integration, and if you can add the proverbial cherries on the sundae, then amazing, but don't necessarily go off to complete flight of fancies while we're still trying to block and tackle on the integration. So there's a good amount of freedom there within reason, but definitely from the top of the house, it's let's integrate the experience, the business line, channels, internal systems, approaches. But as we're doing that, there is opportunity to actually have some wins that the client has not seen before. So that's sort of the best of both worlds. That takes some juggling each day, but I think that's the mindset certainly we've taken in our business, and it's proved well so far.
Well, you're speaking like somebody who enjoys his job. I can say that. And it also seems you've had an amazing journey from software geek almost, C# through product management.
I wouldn't say almost, you can say full geek.
Full geek, yeah. Okay, yeah. Good. But metamorphosized into a product manager and then working for a bank and so on. But going back to those early days of Drexel, knowing what you know now, what different path might you have taken? As clearly you've turned out to be a polymath, but you could have done a whole bunch of things. Are there things you wish you might have done instead?
Not at a high level, but I think potentially look at maybe, I don't know, specific courses or specific types of internships that may have exposed me to, you know, the things I know now that I wish I knew then. And some of that might not even be technical. It could be like managing relationships, managing people, these sort of things that when you get to the real world post-university, like, oh, this is tricky. This is harder than a math problem. How do I do that? So not at a high level. I've been very lucky and really wouldn't change much, but I guess if I could turn it into whatever is worth my advice, is just that, you know, keep curious, always try to learn and improve and grow. Again, it's one of those, it sounds very kind of corny, but you use the term metamorphosis. This is very like ancient wisdom. Like the only thing that's constant is change. Again, it sounds very, very cliche, but it's cliche because it's true. So put yourself in uncomfortable positions, do things that you may not think are your strengths in low stakes environments. And as you mature, something you thought may have been high stakes, actually it's kind of low stakes. So if you fail, it's okay. And learning, you know, what are those high and low stakes. But yeah, I don't think I changed much at a high level, but you know, I may have put a little more money on certain stocks or these sorts of Marty McFly what if moments. But other than that, I'm pretty grateful and lucky for where I am. So I wouldn't change much.
Sean, thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Many insights there, which I'm sure people are going to appreciate. And thank you again.
Thanks for having me. It's a good conversation.
Thank you for tuning into Kaplan Connects. If you enjoyed the episode, please be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss what's next. If you'd like to learn more, head over to kaplan.com and check out the team behind the show.